Good morning.
I'd like to talk today about the path of meditation, starting from the beginning all the way through non-dual practice. You know, we suffer because we have forgotten or looked past our essential nature. We are in ignorance of who we truly are. Normally, we consider ourselves and we are taught to be a collection of thoughts, feelings, bodily sensations and perceptions, what we think, what we see, what we feel, what we hear. That is, we are a separate self living inside the body-mind and made up of the body-mind. That is who we are taught to be. We sometimes call this the ego-identified mind, or the small mind, or the dualistic mind, because once you feel you are inside the body-mind and the world is out there, there is a separation of me and other that's intrinsic to that, which is dualistic. And the reason why this is important is as long as this small mind is running our lives, and for most of us, we spend our entire lives living in service of the dualistic mind. We're tending to its fears. We're trying to make it more comfortable, more in control, having a more pleasant experience, trying to optimize our lives, our vacations, our spouses, our day-to-day experience to make it more and more pleasant. And as long as we are in service of this and we feel separation, we experience suffering. Because the small mind is always seeking a different moment, a more pleasant moment, and there's nothing more painful than seeking something because you don't think you already have it. So part of this is this small mind, this part of us that seems like there's a doer, a decider, a person with impulses and intentions, it wants to find a more pleasant life. And one of the ways in our culture we do this, of course, is through consumption. We buy a bigger car, a better house, a bigger yacht. We want to have a more pleasant dinner, a more beautiful experience. And of course, we all know this, that it doesn't make us happy. We can consume till the cows come in. We can try to make every moment perfect, and it becomes a life of pain and misery, always fearing the moment that we're going to fall short. So sometimes this doer or decider, this small mind in us, then starts to search for a spiritual path because it thinks it needs to be in a better or a different person to be peaceful or to be happy. So because of this, this meditation, as we start the path, the small ego-identified mind undertakes the path in order to achieve some kind of goal, whatever that goal might be. I want to be enlightened. I want more peace. I want to be a better parent. I want to feel freer in my life. I want to feel happy. None of this is unskillful, but the point of it is, from that point of view, the separate self is in charge of our meditation practice. And from that point of view, the separate self is believed to be what we are, and meditation is considered to be an activity that we do. So we start out that the ego-identified mind come to a spiritual practice because it's seeking something better than what it has. So we come to practice. And the first thing we notice in practice is the small mind is not comfortable in the moment. Our mind has the attention span of a gnat. It's just always wandering off in search of something else. So we begin with concentration instructions, coming back to the moment. In Vipassana, we often use the breath as our anchor to do this because it's present, it's moving, it's so accessible. But the body can also be used. There are techniques that use body scans. Hearing can be used. Anything that's in the moment, right here and right now. And there's a lot of benefit from this concentration practice. It's calming. It gives the incessant chaos in the mind a break, so that we have a, it breaks the stress cycle. It's like, oh, thank goodness, a moment of peace and calm here. And it suppresses the hindrances. It struck me when Chaz DiCapua came during the beginning of COVID and did an online retreat for us. I think it was our first online retreat. He suggested we do just concentration practice because he felt people were stressed out and that's what they need to do. And all of us, in moments when we're overwhelmed or something happens and we feel a lot of stress and tension, we come back to this concentration practice, right? We just take a breath or two. We come back to the moment. We come back to the body. So many people continue to stay in a concentration practice. That's really all they're looking for, is a break in the stress, just a moment of peace. I started in Zen practice and did a concentration practice for about 5 years. And it was enough. It was what I wanted. It did the trick for me. And then after about 4.5 years, I got restless. It seemed flat. It seemed like I had plateaued, and it was a confusing time for me. And I want to introduce a concept that we don't often entertain but needs to be said, which is oftentimes when a practice feels stale or it feels like it's not so shiny anymore or we lose interest in it, we usually blame ourselves. We usually go, oh, I'm a terrible meditator. I simply don't want to do my practice anymore. When what can actually be happening is that practice has served its purpose and it's actually ready to be let go. These practices in the famous sutra analogy, they're like rafts to cross a river. The raft of a certain practice gets us across a certain river, and when we reach the other shore, it's time to let that raft go. It would be burdensome to continue to carry that raft beyond the shore. Now, sometimes, of course, we lose interest in practice. Something rough is coming up. Some fear or some old pain is coming up, and we simply don't want to see it. But we know the taste of that. We know the taste of active avoidance. What I'm talking about here is something different. When a practice has done something and we are ready to move on. So I just want to throw out the idea, if your practice feels staled or plateaued, it might be ready. It might have done what it set out to do. It might be ready to move forward. So many of us do. We come to insight practice. And for me, coming to insight, I wanted something I could bring into the texture of my day-to-day life as a working mom, because the concentration practice was something I had to sort of go do in a quiet room. And here it was hard to change practice, because instead of having an exclusive concentration that excluded everything else, Vipassana is opening that field of attention of concentration to include everything. We're actually watching what is going on in the seemingly separate body mind that we call me. So as we sit in Vipassana, a place that witnesses or observes the flow of the body mind starts to develop. We watch the thoughts, we watch the feelings, we watch the sensations, we watch everything come up as we simply sit and witness it. Now, there are several benefits that come from this practice. One is that we see things simply come and go. We just see everything is impermanent. That intense emotion that we were so wrapped up about and we just couldn't think or do anything else because we were so angry or anxious or whatever it was, a week, a day, or an hour later, it's gone. And we're like, oh, goodness, that was so intense. Now it's just not there. So it creates that we're able to like let it go a little bit. We're able to have a little bit more wiggle room around whatever we think or react to because we know it's temporary. The other thing that begins to develop is we notice that what is watching these objects is not actually the same as the objects themselves. Thich Nhat Hanh had a famous saying, I see my anger, I smile to my anger. Now, what he's saying here is me, the watcher, and the anger are not the same thing. We begin to recognize we are not what we think. We're not what we feel. We're not our body sensations. We're not what we hear. We're not what we see. So what watches is different than the flow of life experience. And the third thing that comes up in a Vipassana practice is because we're making space inside, is old unhealed wounds, reactivity, and hurts that we've shoved aside have room to come up and we see them. And so it's a healing process. As old unhealed wounds come up, we're able to sit with them, to hold them, and let them simply be there because they're there until they can resolve or they have a chance to shift in us, which is a lovely fruit of practice. A different way to say all these things, as Charlotte Joko Beck said once, is we are creating ABC, a bigger container inside of ourselves. We just simply have more room inside that we can hold what happens to us in life without reacting immediately to it. We can hold that when we've been triggered and notice we've been triggered and not immediately respond with the unskillful, snarky remark that we regret the minute it comes out of our mouth. And having ABC is a huge benefit in life. We find we're more skillful. We make less blunders in relationships. We're able to hold needs and fears a little bit more lightly. Life tends to go smoother. Life gets better. It's a huge benefit. And again, for many people, this is enough. It's enough reason to do the practice. And many people will stay here totally content with a Vipassana practice, seeing more deeply, finding more space inside, not being quite so reactive. Sometimes we feel should, like I should want more, or I should do more. You know, as Americans, part of our culture that actually is kind of destructive is trying to be bigger, better, faster. But the point in these practices is when we're at home in them, when you're at home in a Vipassana practice and it feels just right, we respect that. We don't all need to get a PhD in everything. What we want, if it's there, we should simply stay there with contentment. An analogy of this is I have a sister who's a marathoner. And I used to go down, we'd go jogging together when I'd visit her. And I had a relationship with my jogging. I was a very casual jogger. I figured I would run 3 miles, which seemed to have the best benefit in terms of not wearing out my joints, my hips, and my knees, but getting the maximum cardiovascular benefit. So I was a 3-mile jogger and I was out. I was the casual jogger. My sister would leave me behind in the dust. Her morning jog was 13 miles. And again, we simply wanted different things. I was happy with my limited experience. She had a bigger experience. So it's important to know where you are, what you want from your practice, and if it's okay with you. So for many of us, we stay in a Vipassana practice. But for myself, after some time, I started to get restless again. There was something I wanted. I wasn't quite sure what it was, but it was not being presented in Vipassana practice. And I have to say, this was an uncomfortable time because I felt like, oh my goodness, I've outgrown my house again. I need to find another place to live. So it was a mixed feeling. But what was happening for me is Vipassana, like a raft, had served its purpose. And the purpose is that Vipassana is not, our thoughts are not who we are. The body is not who we are. My perceptions are not who we are. Everything I experienced was not who I was. Even the observer and the witness was just another object in the flow of experience. So a burning question began to arise in me. My Vipassana practice became stale. It felt flat, but I didn't know where to go. And the burning question in me was Ramana Maharshi's famous question, who or what am I? If I am none of these things I was taught who I was as a child, what am I? That question became so strong that it let me know that the Vipassana practice had done what it was supposed to do, and it was time to move on. Now, I do want to say at this point in practice, not everybody will reach it, but when you do, there's a shift that needs to happen in practice at this point. Since we now know we are not the body mind, the small mind that's been in charge of our practice, the identification with that body mind separation has to let go. The meditator needs to stop doing and step aside from being in charge of the practice. We know we're not the body mind, therefore, the body mind cannot be in charge of practice. It cannot transcend itself. We talked about this at the retreat the last weekend of what is it like to sit and watch things go by without a meditator? What does that feel like to have no one witnessing? There is no one seeing, there is no one hearing, there is no one sensing. There is simply seeing, hearing, and sensing. Lou has a little bit different language he uses for this. He calls it non-doing practice. In other words, meditation can no longer be something that the separate small mind does. There is no doer. And I know we taught a class about this recently. So the burning question is, who am I? Who am I? So let's explore this right now. I want to do this in the style of Mickey Singer, who says, so who are we really? So if somebody came up to me and said, hi, who are you? I might say, oh, I'm Susan Weir. I'm married to Lou Weir. I'm retired. I've got a couple of grown sons. And it would be legitimate if the person was asking from a deep level to say, well, that's lovely, but if your name was Betty Smith instead of Susan Weir, wouldn't you still be you? Wouldn't you still be the same person? And if you weren't married, say life handed you that you were single, wouldn't you still be here? Wouldn't you be the same person? And if you were 10 years ago working, even as today you are retired, wasn't that still you working there? Wasn't that the same thing? So I'd say, okay, all right, let me, okay, it's obvious I'm not my education, I'm not my life story, I'm not my business experience. Okay, here's a deeper part of me. I was interested in this spiritual search. There's a part of me that really wants to know the deeper truth of life, that's looking for an ease in life that's beyond the cultural values I was taught, and I came to this practice, and I might be interrupted again, and the person might say, hey, that's a lovely story. That's a great story. But I didn't ask you what happened in your lifetime. I asked, who are you? You've described all these experiences, but who had these experiences? Wouldn't you still be in there if you'd lived in a different area or you didn't do your spiritual search and maybe you did something else with your life? Well, wow, that's a good question. So I might go, okay, I'm this body. I'm always in the body. I am my body. well, but this body that you see in the mirror right now is quite different than the body you saw as a 40-year-old. Is it not? It's all wrinkly and your hair is gray now. In fact, every 7 years, all the bodies, every molecule and every cell in your body is different. You're not even the same piece of matter that you were when you were 40. What about as a 10-year-old? Which body are you? If you were suddenly transported back to your 10-year-old body, wouldn't you still be in there experiencing it? Wouldn't that be you? So let's consider this. Aren't you the one who is in the 10-year-old body and experienced the 10-year-old's life? Isn't that the same one that's here now, that's here this morning, listening to this talk, that will be here your entire life? So you look at what has changed, you know, aging, life experience, and so forth. But what about you? The one who is looking, who is experiencing the human life, experiencing all these things. Isn't there a continuity of being? Wasn't it the same being that looked at the 10-year-old, the one that first opened its eyes as a newborn being, the one that is the same as the one that's here now and will be here the rest of your life? Well, okay, I am the one who's been in here all this time, experiencing all the experiences. There's a continuity here, sort of like the string that holds a series of beads together into a necklace. That is the consistent factor through which the narrative of my life makes sense as all these things are changing. Now we are getting closer. So back to Ramana Maharshi's question, who am I? Who is it that experiences this body? Who thinks these thoughts? Who feels the heartbreak and the happy moments? Well, we're not the world, we're not the body, we're not the mind. We can eliminate all of the subjective conditioned objects. But who are we? One way of answering this question is to let go of everything that changes, everything that can come and go. In other words, it's not essential to who we are, because sometimes those things are present and sometimes those things are absent, and seeing what is left. If there's something that is absolutely essential and cannot be taken away, that must be who we are. So from our Vipassana, we know we aren't the external objects we perceive as the world. We also aren't the internal ones, thoughts, feelings, sensations, either. These all come and go. They constantly change, but we don't disappear when the objects do. So please join me right now. Let's do a short guided meditations. Just take a few moments. So please move back to your meditation positions, or if you're listening to this, become comfortable, and this will be easier to do with your eyes closed. So we're sitting, noticing the flow of experience, and now let's imagine suddenly that things disappear from where you are sitting right now, one by one. Let's imagine that smell disappears. You're there and the sense of smell is suddenly not there. Imagine that the sense of sight is disappeared. Even though your eyes are closed, there's still a sense of seeing behind the eyelids. Imagine that's gone, just goes blank. Now imagine that body sensation disappears. like in sleep. That 1 minute you're experiencing all the sensations of yourself sitting on the cushion, and the next moment that is simply gone. And then I know this is difficult because you're hearing my voice, but imagine sound disappears. Sound is simply silent. And then thoughts, the activities of mind, memories, thinking, planning, imagine it all drops away. It's very quiet now. Probably like being in a sensory deprivation tank, but you, the experiencer, are still there. You're experiencing this silent, this darkness, this absence of anything. Now imagine your awareness disappears. So how are you doing now? It's pretty simple. Without awareness, you would not be here. You would not have any experience. Awareness, or knowing, is the one indispensable element. So in this search of who we are, what is absolutely essential, we find we can let go and imagine letting go of everything except awareness. So that is the essential ingredient. The one thing you cannot take away and still exist. Awareness or knowing, just that sense of being, is your essential nature. You live in the seat of awareness, in being. We are the one deep inside who is looking at and experiencing the world, the body, and the mind. Deep, deep behind everything, you are in there experiencing the human existence. And we miss this simple fact of being. Not because it's so far away, not because we have to sit for 30 years to find it because it's elusive. We miss it because it is so close to us. It completely saturates. Awareness saturates every experience we have. It is what illumines our lives. It's so basic and intrinsic that we simply move right through it. We walk right over it because it is silent and transparent. So you are at the seat of being, primordial before experience arises. So to speak, everything in front of you is everything you experience. Some experiences are further out, some closer in, but all experiences have a distance from you. You there at the center of being. So behind all of experience that arises in front of your being, if everything disappeared, is your being, the part of you that can say, I am, I exist. And you don't have to think about it. You know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that you are. You are the one who knows, who is aware of all the thoughts, the feelings, and the world. So at our most innermost temple, the question that we are pursuing, we are exploring, is at the deepest inside core of us, there is consciousness, pure, open, transparent awareness. And that is where you live. Now that you are in the center, you know you are being, experiencing everything. You have always been there. This has never been born. It's never gone away. Nothing in life has diminished it, dimmed it, dented it. It's nothing we obtain or develop. It's always been there, unshakable. Ramana Maharshi calls this a continuity of conscious awareness of being. Thank you. Please end your meditation now. Come back in the room. Open your eyes. So this is non-dual practice, moving inward, finding the seat of being, exploring what its nature is, what its qualities are, what it means. In the Dharma terms, we look at this because it is so transparent, we call it emptiness. And as in the Heart Sutra, emptiness produces form, the body, mind, the world of creation. And this body, mind, world of creation is nothing other than emptiness or awareness. So here's a quote from Rupert Spira. Meditation, non-dual meditation, is now understood differently. It is no longer an activity that we do. Meditation is understood to be what we essentially are. We are simply resting in the core of our being. And the separate self is understood to be an activity that thought does from time to time. So here we come to non-dual practice. It's the exploration of this innermost being and its nature. Now, it's different than Vipassana because Vipassana, we sit at the center and we look outward. We go outward to the flow of activities, thoughts, feelings, sensations, perceptions that flow along in front of us as our experience of life. In non-dual practice, we move 180 degrees to the opposite and we now sink inward, back to our being, back to what is primordial in us before experience arises. So what's there before anything arises? So as we get to know this core, this unconditioned ground, the entire promise of the Dharma, the realization that started the whole wheel turning, the realization the Buddha had of his nature, that is the foundation of our tradition, actually of all spiritual paths, begins to unfold. I'd like to close with a poem here that Bridget Norman, who some of us know here, Bridget actually splits her time between children in Scotland, here in Ann Arbor and Seattle. So she's here a few times a year and is a non-dual practitioner. And she shared with me some poetry she wrote and said it would be fine to read it to the Sangha. So I'd like to close with one of Bridget's poems. The poem is called Through the Wide Open Window. The boundary between being here and not being here is becoming faint. In these days, when I attune to this in-between place and slip free of the solidity of this body, and this story of me, a boundless window opens through which air and light and this beautiful world and the spaciousness of the universe pours through, and with it comes joy and love and freedom. Then there seems to be no boundary at all, no particular place to be or not to be. Yet no unique life to live or not to live. just this experience of expansion and deep, intimate connection with everything as it is, ordinary and miraculous and profoundly at one with all life on the earth. And then I understand the inevitability of letting go and the possibility of letting go with ease, of simply floating through the wide open window into the wonder. Thank you.